Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
People in the United States are saying, oh, how wonderful it is to see people in Egypt rising up to advocate and struggle for democracy, when I think that struggle still needs to take place here in the United States. The idea that we have a democracy in terms of, at least in terms of how the term is popularly conceived, is laughable. I mean, this is, you know, this being able to vote for one of two Wall Street-funded, military-industrial complex-funded candidates, to me, does not speak to the concept of democracy that most people claim to have.
That's the voice of Jared Ball. Jared is a professor of communication studies at Morgan State University, where his research interests include the interaction between colonialism, mass media theory, and history. He's also a journalist for the alternative news service The Black Agenda Report. Jared speaks to us today about recent events in Egypt, warning us to be cautiously optimistic. He also engages in a lively discussion about social change in the North American context, so stay tuned.
And we're very excited to celebrate the victory of the Egyptian people. We've invited Dr. Jared Ball. He's an assistant professor of communications at Morgan State University. He's also a journalist and a columnist with the Black Agenda Report. We're very privileged to have him on our show. Welcome to our show, Dr. Ball.
It's a pleasure.
Now, we have been watching the uprising of the Egyptian people. On January 25th, we were on air and we were hearing about these amazing demonstrations. And of course, you know, as any Latin American, your heart is in your hand and you're just hoping and waiting and praying. And it's such a wonderful thing to see, to hear the news that this the Mubarak has stepped down. What was your reaction in the U.S.?
Well, I mean, I can't speak for everyone in the United States, and I don't know that I'm really qualified to say much on the topic at all. And I think a lot of the people who are carrying on the discussion of Egypt in the United States themselves are not really clear and are taking positions that I'm not so sure are based in, you know, a real depth or you know, a serious understanding of the situation there. But I'll ask you, and I'll ask your listeners. I mean, I just have a couple of questions, and those questions, on the one hand, yeah, so on the one hand, it's great. We want to see people advocating for an end to military dictatorship, and we want to see people advocating for, and I guess at the best, you know, in a certain sense, we want people to advocate peacefully for equal human rights and treatment and so on. But a couple of questions that I have relate to things that I haven't seen a lot of discussion of, at least not in the United States, which surround the class and sort of racial element to this. And I understand we're talking about a North African country and not the United States, but it seems to me that there seems to be a urbanite, and in the context of Arab or the African world, an urbanite, middle class, and white uprising. We only just recently heard of anything involving working people and the laborers going on strike, but I have not seen a lot of reports of, you know, what's happening around the rest of the country, certainly around the more racially dispersed and segregated black and African segments of the Egyptian population. And I think that speaks to sort of what my concerns are initially, that and what this will turn into. You know, if it took more than a week or two for the working people to go on strike, that means that most of the people who, at least to me, it suggests that most of the people who were protesting throughout the duration of this are more middle class, you know, young, college age, maybe trust fund baby type folks who can have the luxury of being out of work for that long, and who can assume certain risks regarding repression and so on and so forth, and who also, in this sense, would have the most to gain from a shift towards what those in the United States call democracy, that is, which is what we've seen in this country, particularly in the black struggle in the United States, which has been mostly the concessions made by the state have benefited a middle and upper middle class handful, while the majority of Black America remains mired in actually worsening conditions, even related to what they faced in the 50s and 60s. So I'm just not really sure. And then, of course, we heard Mubarak said he's stepping down, but he's given control over to the military, and the military is funded largely, if not entirely, by the United States tax dollar. So I'm not entirely sure what this means in terms of a real fundamental shift in power and so on. So I'm a little more reserved. I do wish the people in Egypt the best, and I know that the people in this country and around the world are supporting them out of goodwill and good nature. But I do have some serious questions as to what exactly we're calling revolution, and based on what I do know a little bit about my own country, calling things revolutionary change often mislead or misinterpret or misunderstand or misrepresent that which has actually occurred.
You're quite right to be suspicious. Throughout Latin America, we've heard the whole expression of independence, you know, and we celebrate our independence, but really all it was is a shift of power from the Spaniards to the local Spaniards who were born in Latin America. And in the context of North America, I'd like to talk with you about the co-option of revolutionary movements within the States. When Barack Obama was elected, many people came out under this banner of hope of change. And I should ask you, how has this, you know, play out for Black American citizens in the U.S.?
My senior colleagues at BlackAgendaReport.com have done and have been doing for years now some of the more cutting-edge criticism of Obama even before he became a senator. People in our circles had been watching his rise with a great concern, and this sort of speaks to what you and I were both talking about. And I think if we were to look at and interpret Obama's rise, even in the context that you described of Latin American history and shifts, certainly if we looked at it in terms of African world shifts, we would see a pattern here of elite segments or segments of our communities who are selected by the elite, the former colonial elite, determining for us who our leadership will be, supporting them so as to give the veneer of change, when in reality, for a majority of the people, things, if at best, stay the same, if not get worse. And certainly I think we can see that happening with Black America and really just the country in general in terms of what most hoped they would get when they voted for Obama. There haven't been significant shifts. So in terms of even this Egyptian context, you know, from my most recent commentary on Black Agenda Report, I mean, one of the questions I was trying to raise was just this connection where a lot of people who support Obama, even those who support him critically, are now willing to be ecstatic and hopeful about what's happening in Egypt without raising, at least enough for me, the question of Obama's foreign policy or even our own agenda. I mean, all the people who are supporting the Egyptian uprising now, my guess is that none had this as part of their agenda in preparing to vote for Obama. That is, that nobody I'm aware of was saying, we want freedom for people in Egypt, and that means the United States has to stop funding the Egyptian military and the Egyptian police so as to also keep a nice foothold and in the so-called Arab world within the African continent, protecting, you know, the policies and the agenda of Israel as well. Nobody was saying, you know, we need to have Obama withdraw funding or support for dictators like Mubarak. Nobody had a problem with that when they were voting for Obama and seeing him as revolutionary change. And he has not said anything now that leads me to believe that he's willing to even hold that out as a carrot, saying we will withhold funding if you don't implement a democracy. Certainly, they can't do that in terms of their relationship with Saudi Arabia and other regimes around the world, where the politics and the economics of the United States certainly trump any claim to supporting freedom and democracy. And again, that's sort of what I was saying, and my colleagues were saying in advance of Obama, in terms of Obama's election to the presidency, or even the Senate, in terms of Black America and others. You know, what is on our agenda? What agenda, what platform did we present to Obama in advance of his election, putting certain demands on him? And for the most part, and my colleagues have argued that this was the first time, in 2008 was the first time Black America had never had an agenda at all to put before a president. And because of his blackness, we just all sort of gave him a pass and said, we want to see him get elected, and then maybe later we'll deal with him then. And of course, which at that time it's too late. So, you know, I guess the broad stroke contradictions and hypocrisies that I see regarding Egypt, Latin America, and Black America vis-a-vis Obama and certain appointed and acceptable leadership, acceptable that is from the perspective of those in power. And I think that until we at the bottom, so-called, and we at the grassroots level devise a broad-based but clearly specified political agenda from which we determine who our leaders will be and who we support, we won't see really any real fundamental change. So whether it's South Africa, whether it's Latin America, certainly whether it's the United States, and now and whether it's Egypt, I think we need to keep a close eye on the conditions of the most oppressed in those communities. And that is always, of course, the poorer and usually the darker complexioned people. And until I see major changes for all those groups, I'm going to be reserved at best in terms of my excitement and support for these nominal changes.
I want to talk a little bit about that as well. On January 17th, we celebrated the Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and now we're in Black History Month in Canada and throughout the U.S., I imagine. There is people talking about the gains that have been made. Now, Martin Luther King Jr. said quite rightly, I'm actually going to quote him, he says, I am convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin with the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society, where machines and computers, profit motives, and property rights are considered more important than people. The giant triplets of racism, militarism, and economic exploitation are incapable of being conquered. You know, every time I hear that, it just speaks, because, you know, we all can connect to that universal truth of, you know, being degraded from our value as human beings to cogs in this machinery of profit. So let's talk a little bit about that, because we do have people who feel this change is needed. So where do we begin this revolution of values? Does it begin in the school? Does it begin in the street? Who is responsible? And how does our personal lives connect to that political sphere? Because our leaders don't speak for us, and I think most of us know that by now.
Well, one of the things that sort of goes back to the point I was just making is that those that we refer to as our leaders were not people that we developed out of our own organic movements. So the first thing that I think is important to remember about people like Dr. King is that Dr. King and Malcolm X and, you know, others like Rosa Parks and Ella Baker, they were products of movements. Dr. King did not start any movement. Malcolm X did not start any movement. They were built and developed by the grassroots for the grassroots. And that's what separates them as leadership from most of the people that we now point to as our leaders today, certainly in terms of elected officials. And I, you know, honestly, I don't have any cut and dry solution. Otherwise, you know, we wouldn't be having this conversation. You and I would be talking about how, you know, Jared's universal solution saved the world, and I would be happy to accept the praise for that. But the reality is, I don't have any solution that others haven't already developed, and it's just a question of to what extent we implement it. And by that I mean, my preference has always been to argue and debate within those who claim to agree with a certain set of agenda items, some of which you just laid out in terms of Dr. King's quote, and then to say, well, if you believe that we need a revolution or a revolution of values and we need to overthrow capitalism, which is, again, what also Dr. King was calling for, and if we need to aggressively wipe out white supremacy and you agree with that, well, then we need to do a number of different things. And we need to develop alternative political parties, I think. We need to develop agenda items that are specific that we hold elected officials accountable to. I think we should engage in anything that has ever been on the table should be on the table now. Sanctioned and unsanctioned, all of those should be put on the table as potential actions or agenda items, and we have to organize and act differently, and we have to act in unsanctioned, even risky ways to develop movements that will bring about this kind of change we say we want. But what we cannot continue to do is continue to claim that we praise Malcolm X and Dr. King and all these other wonderful people, and then simply just go and vote for the next Democrat in the context of my country, or, you know, vote for the next top-down delivered leader, and so on and so forth. And we need to be, you know, and if anything that we can learn from what's happening in Egypt is that we need to be doing things that disrupt the normal flow of business as usual. And that's, again, what Dr. King was calling for and gearing up for at the time he was assassinated. One other thing just very quickly about that is that we have to aggressively reclaim the true history and legacy of Dr. King and many others, including Malcolm X, both of whom have had their images wildly attacked and distorted and reduced in ways that don't allow for people today to understand who they're talking about, and certainly not to develop organized efforts around the things that these two men and many other women and men like them were arguing be considered as, you know, not only ideologically and politically, but in terms of specific action items. So that's really, you know, in that vague area is really the only thing that I can suggest, that people who already claim to agree with these people need to agree beyond the principle and agree in terms of action. And that's where I think we come most into trouble. And I think that that is one of the reasons why we haven't seen the kind of leadership emerge that we would like to see. We haven't seen another Malcolm and another King, because we haven't developed the organizations that develop these individuals.
That's an important point. When we look through Latin America, we look at Bolivia now for an example of a democratic participatory society, and we're seeing, you know, the first indigenous president elected, the first indigenous woman elected as vice president. We're seeing communities who now put their own voices, you know, when budgets are being developed for their communities. There is participation in what is needed and how would our resources be invested. And I think that didn't, and I should point out, that didn't just happen. People went out and put their bodies on the line to make it happen, put force behind their value system and what they believe needed to be changed. And when we see President Evo Morales speaking, he has behind him a whole mass of people. You know, he was elected with a margin of majority that we can only dream of in Canada or in the U.S. So these kinds of movements take personal capital, that's a terrible word to use, but I mean, it takes our personal person being there, right? Our commitment, not just in thoughts, but in actions. I look at the changes in the U.S., though. It's easy for us to be really discouraged at times. But within the U.S., there is a lot of vibrant movements constantly fighting against, you know, the rabid discrimination of particular citizens, Black Americans, immigrants, particularly those of brown color. And you see people fighting against mass incarceration, people fighting against regressive immigration policies. So those movements are there. So what keeps us from joining forces and coming together?
Well, I mean, that's a difficult question, but I think that, at least from my perspective in the United States, I mean, one of the many issues that prevent us from having the proper unity that we need to have is that most of our experiences are still more or less mediated through someone else's worldview, and a worldview that is hostile to all groups involved. And by that, I mean, you know, usually, too much at least, Black people only know about Latin Americans through some sort of mediated popular media experience, and vice versa. So there isn't enough on the ground, face-to-face, offline interaction to where oppressed groups can, including poor white folks, can really sit down and have an honest dialogue about what's going on and how they can work together. Too often we're pitted against one another, and I think this country in particular has an ability to do that unlike anywhere else, given the pervasiveness and the power and the highly concentrated ownership of our media environment. All of that put together allows for this tiny segment, this real minority of obviously mostly elite white men to encourage, you know, disunity in those groups. And then there's also a tendency, particularly in the United States, to allow for gadgets and technology to give us a false impression of progress, and which also allows it, it makes it more easy for us to accept some sort of electoral political leadership being imposed on us as being representative of our goals. So this kind of, again, goes back to my point that so easily was Obama just sort of placed before us from the top down, funded by Wall Street and the military and the legal world to create this illusion of progress and change. And to the extent that that has worked, it has prevented us from, you know, really linking our struggles and so on and so forth. And then, of course, certainly when Latin Americans who are concerned about their specific communities are looking at a Black American population vote for Obama, you know, like 96% to 98%, and then they turn around and see Obama extending NAFTA and extending the fence on the Mexican border and extending and deporting more Latin Americans in his first two years than any other 2-year period in American history. I think a lot of people start to look critically at their relationship with Black people, and certainly Black Americans more often than not are unfortunately so wrapped up in the complexion of our president that we often don't see exactly what it is that he's doing to populations who should be our natural and common allies. So I think that both and all communities involved have to really look more carefully at what's going on. I think we have to start from the fundamental understanding that we're all human beings, that we're all struggling, we're all confused and scared and desperate and poor and existing in hostile, anti-Black, anti-Brown, anti-immigrant societies. And then from that perspective, that point of departure, sit down again with one another and say, you know, how can we do this? We've already seen examples of it. We've seen, you know, one of the most aggressively attacked movements in this country's history have all been the movements where Black and Brown and working white people got together and began to move on the society. And we often forget just how powerful that relationship was between the Chicano and the Latin American radical movements in the 60s and 70s and the Black Power movement in the United States. And we forget just how unified, in many ways at least, most of our real leadership, that be it Dr. King, who did, by the way, as early as 1962, advocate support of armed self-defense, militarized anti-colonial movements in Africa and Latin America, that certainly Malcolm X represented one of the brightest linkages that we've had between our most radical elements and those of the Latin American and African world. And when we think about these leaders, we need to think about their relationship to the broader world and broader communities going in both ways and see, and we have to remember just how much influence within Latin America and the African world the Black American freedom struggle had on their movements, and then build from that and look past the surface level antagonisms and the surface level hostilities and ignorance and see just where we can build a sort of collective grassroots movement. Now, how to exactly do that, obviously I can't say I know because we haven't done it. Otherwise, I would have done it. Should I come on your show and claim that I have the answer, then you and your guests and your audience should look at me even more criticism and hostility, because if I'm saying I know how to do it and it hasn't happened, then clearly I don't want it to happen, and therefore I should be dismissed summarily and with a quickness. So, but beyond that, I really just don't know, other than to advocate among the communities, when the segments of our communities who already claim they know. And that's, again, an important point for me. I'm not arguing with Republicans. I don't argue with the Klan. And I don't argue with conservatives and reactionaries about anything. I rarely even seek to have conversations with them. I'm only interested at this point in dealing with people who already claim to be progressive, who already claim to be radical or revolutionary or forward-thinking or whatever term we want to use, and then to say, if we're already on more or less the same page, we have to begin to behave in organized and unsanctioned ways if we want to see our worldview come to be.
But so much of it also lies in our ability to imagine new ways of identifying our struggles and unifying our struggles. I was thinking about how the way words have been dismissed of their power, like the word democracy has been used interchangeably to declare war on Afghanistan, has been used to invade Iraq or to occupy Haiti. So how can the movement possibly adopt that as our, you know, uniting slogan? So I think beyond that is our ability to imagine different ways to come together and perhaps even to imagine new words to unify our struggles, because I think there's a key point that we're missing there in how our language is so limited. And when we imagine something that has such double meaning, it can be, you know, disrupting to our own ability to move forward.
No, I think that's a good point. And I mean, in many ways, this is one of the reasons why in my own work, I continue to refer to the United States and to the condition of black people in the United States as one of colonialism. And I know that's not a new word in the way that I think you're describing, but the reason that I like to do that is to revive a concept of black America as part of an international anti-colonial movement. I don't use things like democracy to describe, terms like democracy to describe the United States or anywhere in the West, because, again, like you're saying, I think quite rightly, that the term has lost almost all meaning. People equate democracy with capitalism. They equate democracy with this notion of this false concept of a free market and so on and so forth, when in fact, technically speaking, if we got, you know, we could have a democratically elected socialist government or a democratically elected some other form of government as well. So I agree with you. And that was another, actually, one of my problems with what I see happening in Egypt. I mean, people in the United States are saying, oh, how wonderful it is to see people in Egypt rising up to advocate and struggle for democracy, when I think that struggle still needs to take place here in the United States. The idea that we have a democracy in terms of, at least in terms of how the term is popularly conceived, is laughable. I mean, this is, you know, this being able to vote for one of two Wall Street funded military industrial complex funded candidates, to me, does not speak to the concept of democracy that most people claim to have. So I agree that we need new concepts and new ways of approaching it. I've tried to claim a certain newness by going backwards, in a sense, to reclaim certain language that I still think is perfectly appropriate today. And again, in the hopes of saying, look, black America is more an internal colony to the United States, the way indigenous and Native American populations are, the way Latin American populations are, and certainly outside of the United States, I think it's much more appropriate to analyze the conditions of Latin Americans, Africans on the continent, and people elsewhere in the context of a process of colonization and imperialism than it is through some sort of mythological concept of democracy and free trade. But again, exactly how to do that, I'm not entirely sure, but I just wanted to strongly agree with you that somehow new concepts or old and revived concepts or something has to be done to aggressively and radically change the way we conceive of our world as it is today.
Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is Dr. Jared Ball. He's a professor of communication. He's also a journalist and a regular correspondent to the Black Agenda Report. Thank you so much. How can people access your work?
They can find me. They can just Google my name, Jared Ball. I'm also, again, at blackagendareport.com. You can find me at sort of my virtual home is voxunion.com, which is V as in voice, O-X as in Malcolm, union.com. But just Google me. I'm not hard to find. And more importantly, I would encourage all of who are listening to continue to find and look for as many wildly alternative voices they can find and see about how we can cobble all this together into a unified, organized movement. And thank you for your work. I appreciate your program and being invited on. It's an absolute pleasure.
Thank you again for being with us. Take
care. No problem.
Cambia lo superficial. Cambia también lo profundo.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.